Position number 21052, Wheel 2.
Charles Carrington, Wheel 2.
Oh, as I say, we had to draw new boots, and on orders it said we were reveille at 4 o'clock, leave camp at 4:30. We're going to do a 50-mile march. Well, we'd all got new boots on. It was rather a frightening prospect, so we did the old soldier's trick to soften the boots up, and off we went on this. We did 20-mile force march, and then had breakfast, and then we did a 30-mile normal march on top. We were about 2 miles off the end, and we passed the guards' camp, and the order came down the line. There's always enmity between the rifles and the guards. The order came down the line, show the guardsmen what soldiers are. We'll march past at full regimental pace, 180 paces a minute, march to attention, and off we go. So having marched for 48 miles, we went whipping past the guards at full pace. And when we got to the place where we pick up the trucks, of course, back to camp, it sounds remarkable, not one of us had even raised a blister in these brand new boots 50 miles marching, which proved what marvellous boots they were. And then after that, we were put in a holding company, ready to go overseas. There weren't any drafts going out at that time. And shortly afterwards, I got blood poisoning, which had been caused when I fell off the motorbike. Well, when I came out of hospital, all leave was cancelled, getting ready for D-Day. All the drafts had been sent to the different battalions, and so I was the odd bod with younger men, younger recruits, waiting to be drafted. Well, eventually the D-Day started. We were formed up. There was about, if I remember right, there was about 8 or 9 drafts all lined up on the Barrett Square, ready to go to different battalions. And we didn't know where we were going. We'd been ordered to draw khaki drill, in other words, tropical kit. So we really and truthfully expected to go to Norway, and that's typical of the army. But we didn't. We went across to Egypt, and I joined the 11th Battalion, who had been pulled out of the line in Italy, with the whole brigade had been pulled out for a rest period. So I joined the 11th at Mina.
Any details about the voyage there?
No, it was quite uneventful, really. There was we were on a massive boat in those days called the Monarch of Bermuda, which had been a luxury liner before the war. And not a lot that happened on the voyage. There was one of our lads got into trouble, because on the boat there was a party of military prison officers. Now, one of our lads some time previously had been literally kicked to death in a military nick, and my friend, a chap called Reese, had been in prison at the time, and he knew the guards responsible. And strangely enough, two of them were on this draft going to the Middle East. And Rondy Reese was about 6'4", and he was built like a barn door. He was terrifically powerful. And he said he's going to get these two men for killing Ronnie Creighton. One night I was on sentry on the boat, and he came up to me and he said, "Shut your eyes, I'm going past you." And he did. And the next morning, two of these prison guards had got broken noses, puffed up lips. They'd been really beaten terribly. And they said it was Reese who'd done it. Well, there was an inquiry, and of course they came to me and said, did anyone pass you while I was on sentry? Did you see anyone pass you? And I truthfully said, no, I didn't see anyone, because I got the eye shot, but I didn't tell them that, of course. And because of that, they couldn't prove anything against Blondie, so he literally got away with it. But these two prison officers, they were in a hell of a mess. Blondie thought they deserved it, I suppose, in a way they did. But it wasn't a particularly pleasant interlude. But really, that's the only thing that happened. The Monarch of Bermuda was rather a fast vessel, and the escorting destroyers kept ordering our skipper to slow down and regain position in the convoy, because he was finding it difficult, apparently, to steer at the slow speed. Well, once we were through Gibraltar, they ordered the convoy to break up, and the Monarch was told to clear off on their own. So they tested all guns to make sure they were working, and off we went to Port Said and into the transit camp there.
Any knowledge of why these prison guards had gone for that man?
Well, apparently the Clayton, the man who was killed, he was suffering from some breathing difficulties, and he couldn't do the work that he was detailed to do, because as you probably know, in military prisons the work was very, very hard. He couldn't do it, and he collapsed on the floor, and for some unknown reason these two particular guards ordered him to get to his feet, and he couldn't, and they started kicking him. There's no reason. There was a court martial over it, but of course they were cleared because there was nobody to speak on Clayton's behalf. The ordinary prisoners weren't allowed to give evidence. It was only the prison guards who gave evidence, and we never knew the full details of the court martial. But all that happened, they lost seniority of a few months and got away with it otherwise. Which, as I say, the esprit de corps of that regiment, it meant that those two men were marked for anybody who knew them.
So, coming back to arrival in the transit camp in the Canal Zone, please.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, we were in 156 transit, and then after a few days we moved up to Geneva, and there was a training camp there. Where we were going to be acclimatised, which meant that you started off the first day, you stripped to the waist for about 15 minutes, and then you put your shirt back on. Second day, 20 minutes, etc., etc., until in the end you could run around with your bare chest all day long, and it didn't matter. You were already so suntanned, it didn't make any difference. Again, we had quite a strict and heavy training program there for about a fortnight, and then we went up to Mina and joined the battalion. When we got there, we were detailed to platoons, and we were on the canvas, of course. And I'd only been in the tent about 10 minutes. I was stripped down to bathing trunks, and a lad came to the door and he said, anyone here named Carrington? I said, yes, the officer wants to see you. So I started to get dressed, and he said, don't get dressed, just put your hat on. Once your hat's on, you're properly dressed in this battalion. So I put my hat on, went round to the tent, and sort of knocked on the notice board outside, and a voice said, come in. So I went in, and the officer was there writing some details on his book. He said to me, just wait a second, let me finish this, which he did. He looked up, he said, what's your name? So I carried him. So, no, I don't want your full name. What do your mates call you? So I said, well, actually, they call me Carrie. Right, and he stood up, put his hand down, said, hello, Carrie. I am Mike Penn. You call me Mike off parade. Now, again, this was something I'd obviously not come across in training, and it was a wonderful reception, really, to know that the officer was willing to be known and called by his Christian name. But anyway, we settled down, and I went back to the tent, fell in with the platoon, with the company, and with the section, and they'd looked up my record and found that I was a marksman on the Bren gun, so I became the section Bren gunner immediately. Bit more training, went to a rifle training on the beaches at Alamein, where, strangely enough, I got marksman with the... We were given the new, different rifles. They took away the new Mark Fives, and they gave us the old 14-18 pattern assembly Enfield with the 18-inch sword. And with that, I could shoot. With the Mark Five, I wasn't particularly brilliant with the different sights at the back. Anyway, I got that, and just after that, we were on the move again, and we went down to Alexandria, and we got on the Black Prince. We didn't know where we were going at the time, but once we'd left port, they told us we were going to Greece. Well, leaving Alex, the Navy were taking the mickey out of us rotten, telling us that we got to line the port side, and the port side is the left hand when you face the sharp end, and all this sort of rubbish. Anyway, we took it, bit of leg pulling, and off we went to go to Greece and do the invasion of Greece. Well, when we got pretty well there, the approaches to Piraeus, there was a huge minefield. They swept the minefield, and they said it was safe, so we started chugging our way through, and all of a sudden there's a hell of a bang on the left on the port side, and down goes the ship with all our transport on board. So from now on we are really foot sluggers. So, you know, that didn't please us. Well, then a mine came up to the surface around about 50 yards at the most away from the ship. And the gunners on the Black Prince brought everything on the port side that would bear downwards. Erlikons, Bofors, Twin Lewises, all the lot, and they were shooting at his mine and obviously weren't hitting it. And in the end, one of our lads who'd been subject to all this mickey taking, he shouted out, "Why don't you fix bloody bayonets and charge? It's the only way you'll ever hit it." Of course, the Navy boys weren't very pleased at that, but again, they had to take it because they'd taken the mickey out of us, we did the same. Well, eventually we got into the port, and at the port there's a landing quay, and the officer said, "Right, Carry, you're first to land with the Bren gun." So I went up to the side, excuse me a second. when we got to the quay side, as I said, I was ordered to go ashore first with the Bren gun. Well, I get to the side of the landing craft, and I'm just on the start climbing up onto the quayside, and a hand came down to help me, and I looked upwards. Now remember, I've never been in action, I've never fired a shot in anger. I looked upwards, and there is standing a man in a field grey uniform, jack boots, Colt's turtle helmet. He got a Smyzer across his chest, he got two pistols in holsters, he's got cross belts and ammunition, stick grenades in his boots, everything. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I've had it already. And this chap leaned down and said, "Me partisan." I said, thank God for that. So he helped me up onto the shore and shook me by the hand and put his arm down and hugged me and kissed me and God knows what else. And obviously there were no Germans there. They'd cleared off up country, being chased by the partisans. So we did what we call a flag march through Piraeus to show the locals we're there. And on that march, all the population were coming out and offering us drink, vino. So we each took the mug off a pack of the bloke in front and gave him his mug, and we got these mugs full of Retsina, which of course we'd never tasted before, and we thought what a horrible wine it was because it takes the back of your throat out. Anyway, we got into billets, and that night we went down the taverna, as soldiers do, and the only drink we could get was this Retsina again. So we drank it, and after a few days we all got a taste for it, and we thought it was marvellous. So we were quite happy there. We took over what had been a German store, and in the middle of this store there was a massive great wooden case. So one of our lads pries the lid off, and he found it was absolutely full of cigars. So of course we're all going to be gentlemen now, we're smoking cigars, you see. But when we examined them closely, there was a leaf of tobacco wrapped round it. Underneath that was a brown paper tube which was sealed down with glue, and the contents of the cigar were actually brown paper shredded up to look like tobacco. They tasted absolutely horrible. So in the end we threw most of them away and got rid of them. Well, after some time there we were sent out on the control of the roads, mate, searching people coming in to Athens to make sure that no arms were being smuggled in, because by now the ELAS were beginning to be a bit Barbary, and we did that for a few days only, and then we were moved up to a little village called Amphisa, and platoon detachments. There was only about 30 of us in the village. Well, we got quite friendly with the population, and we went down one night to the taverna, and there were some elderly chaps there who told us they belonged to a club which literally translated meant the boozers of Greece, and they asked us if we'd like to join their club. Well, by now we were quite fond of this Retsina, so we said yes, and they told us there was an initiation ceremony. One had to drink an ochre of Retsina. An ochre is 1¼ litres. So we got this drink, and the idea is you fill a glass, link arms with one of them, drink the glass down in one gulp, turn it upside down to prove that you've emptied it, and carry on with another glass to the next man until the ochre has gone. Well, we all did that, and then they congratulated us on being members and said now we're going to have literally a booze up, and they said by 10 o'clock you will all be under the table drunk. So alright, we carry on drinking. Well, I think about 10:15 all the Greeks were under the table, and we literally drunk them on their own stuff. We became heroes in the village. We were the lads who drunk the local boozers under the table. It's a strange idea, but that's how you get known. Anyway, we were there for quite a long time. We had one unfortunate incident. A little boy came round, and we didn't know enough Greek to know what he was asking for, but he was asking for petrol. Petrol, Johnny, petrol. So we gave him some petrol. He got a bottle and we filled it up for him. And he went away. And apparently what he wanted was paraffin. Petrol is a Greek word for paraffin. The Greek word for petrol is benzina. Well, we didn't know this at the time. And we gave him this petrol. And the poor kid went home and tried to use it on a cooking stove, and fortunately didn't have any ill effects apart from scaring his family to almost to death, because obviously it more or less exploded, whereas paraffin would have burnt normally. But anyway, they didn't hold it against us because, as I say, we didn't know enough Greek. But we stayed at Amphisa until the ELAS became really objectionable, and we were pulled out and told to start making our way back to Athens.
What did the ELAS campaign consist of?
Well, at that time, it was just literally taunting the British. They weren't doing any actual actions, but they were taunting us all the time about what they were going to do. They hadn't actually started the trouble. But when they did start, that's when we were ordered to come out of Amphisa and make our way back to Athens.
Did you get taunted?
Did I?
Did you get taunted?
Oh, yes, they were taunting all of us all the time. It's, you go into the tavern to have a drink and some of the ELAS would be there and they'd show their little weapons and say, look what we've got, we're going to use these against you, we're going to fight you, all this sort of thing. It's on one occasion they brought a female partisan who, rather a large lady, quite pleasant but rather large, and she wore two pistols on her hips like cowboys, and on her sleeve she got three stripes. Well, we knew that they didn't have any actual rank in the ELAS, so we wondered what the earned of these stripes, and they told us that she was responsible on one occasion. They'd stopped a German train, and as the Germans got out of the train, this woman had got a captured Spandau, and she killed about 140 Germans, and so they gave her these three stripes, and then they said she will be fighting you before long, so, you know, trying to frighten us off. They didn't really frighten us, but at the same time it was this taunting, and it got on your nerves rather than did any damage.
Did any of the British troops respond?
No, we were told don't respond at all. The only thing that we did, one of our lads, we got the Piat, which was an anti-tank weapon. It said to these chaps, we've got a new anti-tank weapon, and it will burst open a German Tiger or Panther at its maximum range. What we didn't tell him was that maximum range was about 60 bloody yards. You had to get a bit close. But, we told him that we got this in just to give him a little bit of a shock. But apart from that, it was a war of words rather than anything else. And it just wore you down gradually, that's all.
What did the local people think of the ELAS?
Very, very mixed. Some people obviously supported them. I think the majority of the elder people were against them, but the majority of the younger people were in their favour. I think you can understand this, because the ELAS had done some terrific work against the occupying troops, both Italian, Albanian and Germans, and so they were respected as partisans. And I think if one goes back with hindsight, it was rather draconian of us to say you've got to have the king back when they didn't want the king. So really and truthfully speaking, we could understand their point of view. We just didn't like the way they were going about it. Obviously, I mean, you don't like it when people are threatening you all the time. But, as I say, when they really started stirring it up, we were ordered to come out.
Did you see any shooting?
Not in Amphivra, but later on, yes, a lot of it. We got back to Thebes first of all. On the convoy back to Thebes, there were one or two shots fired at us, not a great deal, but one or two. Some of them went through the canvas tops of the trucks, and they didn't hit anybody, thank God. But when we got to Thebes, we were concentrated. We were ordered to obey a scorched earth policy. We had 600 rifles of the new Mark V, 600 uniforms, tons of food and webbing equipment and all this sort of thing. We were ordered to take the bolts out of the rifles and drop the bolts down a huge deep latrine and stack the rifles round all this food and clothing. An officer then poured gallons and gallons of petrol all over it, and as we drew out he fired a Vera pistol into it and just burnt the lot, so they couldn't use it against us. And we were rather shocked at the fact that we were destroying 600 rifles, but we literally couldn't carry them. We hadn't got room to carry them. So we went from Thebes and we went straight into Athens itself. En route, there was a lot of firing at us. Quite a few holes appeared in the canvas. But again, fortunately, no one was hit. We got down in the bottom of the trucks and we weren't hit at all. When we arrived in Athens, we spent one night in a cinema. That was the only place we got. Then we went into a big hotel and commandeered it for sleeping purposes. And after about 3 days, we moved into the Royal Palace and took the old Greek Royal Palace over as our quarters. And we were there for a couple of months while the troubles really blew up. And of course we were involved in a great number of the actions in Athens itself.
Can you take me through them and describe them, please?
Well, we used to go out on swan in patrols and try and find where they were, which usually we were unsuccessful because they were hidden pretty well. And we were ordered to go to a hill called the Odytos. We went up there about 2 o'clock in the morning because it was trying to get in before first light. En route we had a rest period, and during that rest period my number two on the Bren gun vanished. He deserted, which didn't help me very much because I've now got to carry his kit as well as my own. Anyway, we got to the top of Odytos. Unfortunately, one of the patrols went forward and was bumped by the partisans, so they knew we were there. We got into a little basin on the top, and the lads dug in along the ridge. Well, at first light, we were supposed to open fire on a row of houses to keep the partisans down. And instead of that, they started on us, and they had a chap there with a Spandau, and he used to really annoy us. He used to play Lily Mullane on the blasted Spandau. We knew he was doing it deliberately. It used to get us quite annoyed, actually. And he started putting explosive bullets along this ridge. Well, I hadn't got a pit. They hadn't dug me one. I was out in the open with a Bren gun. And when I saw these explosives coming, there's only one thing to do, and that's get down into the basin quickly. So I got down there. Then they started mortaring. A few mortar bombs came over. One of the lads was hit in the back. One or two of the lads were killed. We couldn't move because we were absolutely pinned down. In some way, on radio, they asked the RAF to come across and strafe these houses while we got out. But when the Spitfires arrived, the partisans had captured a Bofors gun. They put a couple of shots off at the Spitfires, which promptly turned tail and cleared off and left the houses as they were, which, again, we were absolutely... We thought we'd got to surrender. There was no way out. And eventually they got the tanks to come up, and they put a tank in the entrance to the Olympic Stadium, which is just down below the Odytos. And they started firing continuously with the 75 mil and with the machine guns, while we started creeping down the hill. And we got out and got back to our billets in the Royal Palace safely. We had to leave, as I said, we left one or two Lloyds behind because they had been killed. Then we did more swanning around. We went into Zapion and the Agora, and a few shots were exchanged and they cleared off and left us. And then we started doing...